Coming up here on KNKX is a story from our show Sound Effect. Here's Sound Effect host Gabriel Spitzer.
Good intentions can often have unexpected outcomes, and Chad Goler's Sojourner knows this from personal experience. He's a Seattle-based playwright who's written a few solo performances, including Black People and Other Newly Dangerous Acts, a memoir in Vanishing Whiteness. He's also a counselor to white parents who've adopted children of color. You see, Chad is Black, and when he was 13 months old, he was adopted by white parents. They also adopted two other kids of color, and this was back in the 70s when there was a lot less awareness of mixed families. Chad's parents did their best to expose him to other people of color. The family even lived in Nigeria for a few years until Chad was five. When they moved back to University Place near Tacoma, they enrolled Chad in Stanley Elementary School, where most of the students were African American. But Chad didn't think of himself as Black, and he had a hard time relating to his Black classmates.
I was not like them at all. In fact, when I first went there, I found them fascinating. They were loud, fast talking and had beads in their hair and, you know, put grease in their hair. These, you know, all this stuff that you didn't have in University Place. So, and then I would take the bus home at night back to where I live. So certainly I learned at a young age that these people were different. Their experiences were very different than mine.
Over time, Chad got more comfortable straddling these two worlds. But as he tells Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing, that balance would soon be upended. For bureaucratic reasons, Chad had to change schools in fifth grade to one that was mostly white.
Everything bad about me I can trace back to the first day of fifth grade when I had to leave a multiracial school and go to a school where I was one of two Black kids. It didn't take long before I began to pick up negative attitudes about Black people.
What did you think of Black people?
Well, I mean, I found I was afraid. I was afraid of, this was the 80s. There was like crack and stuff in Tacoma. I was afraid. I was embarrassed. I didn't want to be. Now, I also identified as a girl, not in a trans way, but I like boys and girls like boys. And there was nobody was talking about gay. So it just made sense that I identified as a white girl. So if you're hanging out where the norm and the beauty standard is thin white girls with blonde hair, that's what I wanted to be.
Could you share some of the things that people said to you and how you absorbed that, identifying as a white kid?
Oh, well, I was called, in fifth grade, I was called like things I didn't even know. Like somebody called me a porch monkey. I didn't even know what that was. Like, it was a dictionary. So I was called like things I didn't even know. And it was called the N-word. People made fun of my lips at that time. You know, having big lips was not a good thing. So I think the hardest part, it's the part that a lot of transracial parents who adopt don't know, is, you know, when a Black kid is called a racial name, they go home with Black parents. They'll go home to the Black parents and get love and love and comfort from people who've experienced that, as well as look like them. So I went home and got the love and comfort. But in my case, the people who were giving me love looked just like my tormentors. So at a very young age, from like 5, 6, I had to learn how to do, who are the good white people? Who are the bad white people? Because all my love came from people, my love and hate, they all looked alike, and children can't bifurcate. So what Black people can do to kind of as a self-preservation mode, if you're Black and you live with Black people, is you can distance yourself from white people. You can, you know, at what length. I didn't have that opportunity. And I would definitely say, in many ways, it felt like walking through a minefield.
Mm-hmm. There's a whole other level to your story that you talk about and you've written about, and that's the protection of white privilege, that umbrella that your parents provided, which everything you just described was able to grow under.
A lot of our privileges and benefits stem from our parents, you know. And so what I didn't know is that my being attached to this white couple made me less Black for other people. They didn't fear me. An example would be, when I would go shopping with my mom, I grew up shopping with my mom all the time, and it was just normal. Until I got older, when I began to separate from my mom, people began to follow me. So when I was with the white woman, I was not seen as a threat. And of course, for me, you know, the ill-intended consequences is that for transracial adoptees, especially in today's world, a lot of these same privileges that we talk about, they have a limited shelf life. And what happens is they ill-prepare the person for the world that they're going into.
So
suddenly it's like whatever's been protecting you now, I'm sending you out. And not only does that no longer protect you, you don't have the skills needed to maneuver yourself.
Can you talk about how you tried to extend that protection of white privilege?
Yeah, so I was a pretty smart kid. So once I learned that people wouldn't follow me if they thought I was with the white lady, even if I wasn't with my mom, I would like pick up an item and like, hey mom, can I get this? And like pick some random white lady. So I would attack, and it worked. People like,
wait, you would just pretend to be with a random white woman?
Yeah, because I didn't want to follow. And as funny as it sounds, it actually worked. I mean, I did it because it worked.
And were they aware you were doing this?
No, I just like, you know, like, hey, mom, you know, because they're over there and I'm here. Like, who's that black kid yelling, hey, mom, you know?
And you did something similar, except it involved a photograph when you were pulled over by the police. Could you talk about that?
When I went to college in 89, my dad and I went and bought my first car. And we ended up buying a 1976 Mercury Grand Marquis, all gold, totally pimped out. And the front window didn't roll down. Now, this is a car a black father would never send their kid, you know, especially to Bellingham. You know, this is Bellingham in 89. Mm. But I liked the car. It was a cool car. So I had in my license, basically, license registration. I had a picture in there. It was like an intention, like, you know, I grabbed both and handed it to him. It was a family picture. And what I saw when he got that, I saw his affect change.
The police officer.
He became very much calmer. So he's the one who told me, basically, hey, this picture makes me feel a lot better.
Because he could see you with white parents.
Exactly. On one level, and you learn very quickly, you know, especially with dealing with police, the goal is just to get yourself home. And for me, the goal to get home were not to be bothered. So, you know, what I learned is whatever you have to do to not get yourself bothered. Now, at the same point, when you are in the front of the head class, the front of the line, nobody wants to go back to the back, regardless of how you got to the front. So for many people, myself included, this whole idea of privilege, like how long can I hold on to this privilege? At the same time, though, it stunts your identity. So I couldn't go forward into my blackness. You know, I couldn't walk into this place, into my black truth, while I'm still holding on to this whiteness.
So how did you break out of that?
It was a while. I mean, I was studying African-American studies. I realized that after 3 years at Bellingham was just not the place I could finish. So I moved to New York, went to Hunter College, I immersed myself, you know, moved to Harlem. You know, for me, it was an immersion. I knew that I just had to get out and immerse myself in different communities of color.
What was your relationship like with your mom and dad when you were making this transition?
You know, they were always very cool. They were always like, we understand whatever we can do. Remember, they were taking this journey too.
You're a playwright, an author, but you also counsel parents who are adopting kids of color or who have adopted kids of color. What advice do you give them?
Well, I think my first piece of advice is that we learn from our parents what to love and value. And I can tell. So I can go into anybody's house and I can tell you what you love and value. If you went into my mom's house, you would say that my mom loves and values books because they're all over every place. How can you raise a child to love and value themselves when you don't love and value people who look like them? So you're telling your children it's important for you to have this strong black identity, to go out and have black friends and all this kind of stuff, but you don't have any.
And one of the things, it sounds like, just backing up a bit, that you were talking about earlier, one of the things that it sounds as though the work that you do with families is to prepare the parents and the children for the removal of that white privilege umbrella.
So it's one thing to take your kid to a barbershop, they're younger, that's cool. But at some point, your child should be at the barbershop and you need not be there because they're going into a world without you. So how do you prepare that? Because at the end of the day, you want to get your child home alive. I want them to be healthy, whole, in alignment. I don't want them to have these really fractured identities. And the parents are usually the conduits to that.
Chad Goler-Sojourner is a Seattle-based playwright, and he spoke with Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing.